Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Anti-government protests in Egypt. A Nigerian mosque is hit by explosions. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Fighting in Cairo between Islamist protesters and police today resulted in the deaths of two people. Egyptian security sources say the violence broke out in East Cairo following calls for action by Islamists who want to overthrow Egypt's military-backed government. At least 100 people were arrested. The Salafi Front, which campaigns for the imposition of Islamic law throughout Egypt, called for a Muslim youth uprising with nationwide demonstrations. The Muslim Brotherhood endorsed a call for protests. Earlier, two senior officers were gunned down in two separate incidents. At least two explosions have been reported outside the central mosque in Kano, Nigeria. The witnesses say they have seen scores of people injured after the blasts in a courtyard outside the building, Kano's Grand Mosque. The mosque is associated with one of the country's most influential Muslim authorities, the Emir of Kano. There are conflicting reports on whether the Emir himself was at the mosque at the time of the bombing. Chaos followed the blasts, which produced heavy smoke. Police gunfire was reported during ongoing rescue operations. Namibians selected a new president and members of the legislature today. Today's election is widely expected to deliver a victory for the ruling Southwest People's Organization, or SWAPO, which has won every election since Namibia's independence from South Africa in 1990. Namibian voters used electronic voting machines for the first time. This is VOA News. French President François Hollande has become the first Western leader to visit one of the African countries hardest hit by Ebola. Mr. Hollande landed in Guinea today and was greeted at the airport by the nation's president and a group of French health workers. During the brief visit, Hollande plans to look at an Ebola treatment center and meet with President Alpha Condé. Reuters reports that rebel leader Abdoulaye Miskine has been released from a Cameroon prison. The release followed the earlier release of 26 hostages being held by FDPC rebels. Miskine was arrested in Cameroon over a year ago and has been accused by the International Federation for Human Rights of war crimes. The FDPC is one of a number of groups fighting the government. Reuters reports that self-proclaimed Libyan Prime Minister Omar al-Hassi is warning of a possible breakup of the country if a rival government sets up its own oil company. Elected Prime Minister Abdullah al-Thani this week appointed a new chairman for the National Oil Corporation. Libya's elected government is believed to be trying to assert control over the nation's oil industry. The conflict between the two governments is posing a dilemma for oil traders who are left wondering who owns Libya's oil. Afghan security forces are guarding a Kabul neighborhood following an attack there by Taliban fighters. Witnesses reported explosions and gunfire in the Wazir Abkar Khan district late Thursday. The attack occurred near the compound of the International Relief and Development Agency. No foreigners were killed in the attack. The Vatican says Pope Francis aims to strengthen ties with Muslim leaders during a three-day visit to Turkey. That visit began today. Two Chinese human rights activists are standing trial on charges of disturbing public order. Guo Feixiong and Sun Disheng were arrested in August of 2013 after taking part in rallies outside a newspaper that had complained of government censorship. The trial began today in the southern city of Guangzhou. Those facing such charges are almost always found guilty and sentenced to several years in prison. The Associated Press reports at least two people, a 12-year-old boy and a 55-year-old woman, were killed by a rocket attack in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk, according to a local official. The UN Committee Against Torture says the United States does not fully comply with its treaty obligations to avoid torture. The report cites alleged police brutality, harsh military interrogations, incarceration in maximum security prisons, and the treatment of illegal immigrants. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
They should be treated like the heroes that they are. They are selflessly giving of themselves. This is a long deployment for most of them. They go for usually at least 6 weeks, if not actually longer, 8-9 weeks. That's very disruptive. It's a hard, hard condition to be in. Obviously, the outbreak is really awful. And they're working under some terribly, terribly strenuous conditions. When they come back, we should be very grateful for their service. They're doing the most noble work there. They're saving lives.
That's Dr. Paul Bidinger. He is the director of the Emergency Preparedness Response Exercise Program at the Harvard School of Public Health. Details coming up. Also in the news, at least two explosions have been reported outside the central mosque in Kano, Nigeria, while the building was crowded with people attending Friday prayers. And Cameroon officials have banned six journalists from reporting. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Music from Rwanda and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, at least two explosions have been reported outside the central mosque in Kano, Nigeria, while the building was crowded with people attending Friday prayers. Witnesses say they have seen scores of people injured and feared dead after the blasts in a courtyard outside the building, Kano's Grand Mosque. The mosque is associated with one of the country's most influential Muslim authorities, the Emir of Kano. There are conflicting reports on whether the Emir was at the mosque at the time of the bombing. Chaos followed the blasts, which produced heavy smoke. Police gunfire was reported during ongoing rescue operations. It is not yet clear how many explosions there were or how many people might have been injured or killed. Kano is a city of more than 3 million people in the northern part of Nigeria. Cameroon officials have banned six journalists from exercising their profession and ordered a stop to several critical radio and TV programs. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's National Communication Council says it suspended journalist Parfait Eyisi of Vision 4 TV, who anchors the program Major Issues, for insulting Martin Belinga Ebutu, director of the civil cabinet at Cameroon's presidency. Ernest Obama, Ernest Belinga, and Romeo Bida, all Vision 4 TV presenters of programs critical of Cameroon President Paul Biya's government, were also told not to practice journalism until further notice for failing to respect professional ethics. Eric Kwamo of Equinox Television received a warning for broadcasting what was described as shocking pictures of a boy with congenital defects. Journalist Jacques Blaise Vie and his La Nouvelle newspaper were also told to stop publishing. Peter Isoka, acting president of the Cameroon Communication Council, says that decision is in no way a gag order on the press his organization was created to protect.
We also have the right to sanction freedom when it goes into excesses. There are stipulations in the law or the decree that will organize the council that give us authority to take certain decisions, irrespective of who.
Esoka also says the Communication Council is not trying to suppress the media and that they are in no way influenced by President Biya's administration.
We are an autonomous body. Yes, we are appointed by the President of the Republic. Yes, but we have a right to use that the authority given to us by the head of state to take certain decisions.
Chalin Diche, president of the Cameroon Union of Journalists, CUJ, told VOA he is worried by the growing intransigence of the National Communication Council, which he says should only play its role as media regulator. He says the main problem in Cameroon is that journalists are not given access to information and at times they go speculating.
News is given in starvation doses and somebody can only give you the news that he likes, especially in our dispensation here in Cameroon. If the news source is not absolutely open and accountable to the public through the journalist, then we have failed.
Reporters Without Borders last year reported that Cameroon's Communication Council had taken a clearly tougher line towards journalists and media, which was reflected in the number of summonses it issued and the suspensions it had ordered. Last month, a military tribunal barred two reporters, Felix Siak Ebolebola of Mutation and Roderick Tongue of Le Messager, from practicing their profession and blocked them from traveling out of the country. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A mass protest today in Lomé, Togo's capital, may signal popular unrest with government as Togo heads to elections next year. The eight-party Combat for Political Alternative in 2015 alliance called for citizens to come out in a huge numbers at today's rally. In Paris yesterday, French President François Hollande warned Togo and three other African countries to modify their constitutions to allow new leadership. The opposition in Togo is demanding a return to the 1992 constitution and a two-term presidency. Lawmakers and President Faure Gnassingbé who have ruled out a change in the constitution which sets no term limits. Mr. Gnassingbé is serving a second five-year term and won his first disputed election at the death of his father, a general who served as president for 38 years. Holding up the example of Burkina Faso, Mr. Hollande yesterday identified Chad, Cameroon, and Gabon as other countries that need to establish presidential term limits. Benin, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda are other countries where autocratic rulers are nearing the end of their terms of office. There is growing concern they might try to change their constitutions. In Ebola news today, a portable diagnostic test for early and fast detection of the virus is being tested in Guinea, the first country struck by the devastating virus that has killed more than 5,400 people in West Africa. If trials are successful, the United Kingdom-based Wellcome Trust says the device, which is called Ebola Check, can be carried to underserved rural areas to identify the virus within 15 minutes. The solar-powered suitcase lab is being tested by researchers at the Pasteur Institute of Dakar in Senegal. The research is funded by the UK Department of International Development and the Wellcome Trust Fund. Meanwhile, President François Hollande of France arrived in Guinea today as health officials there complained about poor coordination of aid efforts to their country. France pledged $125 million to aid the Ebola fight in Guinea, a former French colony. Mr. Hollande is the first head of a non-African state to visit West Africa since the Ebola virus outbreak began. He arrived in Conakry to support the local effort to contain the virus. He was en route to Dakar, Senegal, for a summit of French-speaking West African countries. And in England, the celebrity fashion model Naomi Campbell launched a temporary enterprise in London to raise money to contain the Ebola virus in West Africa. Campbell persuaded Victoria Beckham, Christina Louboutin, Gabbana, and other major dress designers to donate custom fashions to be sold for Campbell's Ebola fund. Dozens of British music stars have come together to record a new version of the song Do They Know It's Christmas to raise money for the fight against Ebola. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the song has not been universally welcomed in Africa, where local music stars have recorded their own Ebola single.
30 years ago, the song Do They Know It's Christmas by Band-Aid raised $11 million to battle the famine in Ethiopia. The organiser of Band-Aid, Bob Geldof, has done it again.
And the Christmas bells that ring there are the clanging chimes of doom.
A new generation of musicians plus a few old faces have recorded a reworked version of the same song to raise money for the fight against Ebola. Geldof says the international community has not given nearly enough to fight the disease.
They need 20 times that. So this record is an attempt to try and bridge that, certainly to push it. So we're doing Band-Aid Germany, Band-Aid France.
Bring peace and joy this Christmas to West Africa.
The song has topped the charts in Britain. Editor of music magazine NME, Greg Cochran, says now, 3 decades later, the song could reach millions more people.
The way we consume music has changed dramatically. So, you know, obviously this version of Band-Aid is going to be available on a few different formats.
But the Band-Aid 30 release has not been universally welcomed in Africa. Ethiopian music teacher Ezra Ababate says even the title, Do They Know It's Christmas, is patronising.
The Ethiopians have accepted Christianity in the first century. You know, we know it's Christmas. But the thing is, you know, as I said, it's labelling the entire Africa like a country. It's a very bad expression. Africa is a continent, it's not a country.
Several African stars, including Salif Keita and Mori Kante, have come together under the group name 3D Family to record an alternative fundraising song titled Africa Stop Ebola. All proceeds go to the charity Doctors Without Borders. Sung in French and local languages, it urges people who are ill to visit a doctor and warns them to avoid touching dead bodies. Artists on the track include Senegalese rapper Didier Awadi, who also criticised Band-Aid 30.
Anytime you have a problem in Africa, Bob Geldof, I'm the angel coming to help the Africans.
Medical experts say the Ebola virus spreads so quickly in West Africa because people lack information on how to fight the disease. Music might change that, says Guinean singer Mori Kante, who also appears on Africa Stop Ebola.
Ouais, il faut que l'information passe partout, mais je crois que l'art et la culture est le chemin le plus court.
He says that art and culture is the shortest route to communicate with these villagers so that they understand the importance of being able to avoid this scourge. It's hoped that both music tracks will raise money and raise awareness of the disease. The number of Ebola cases in Liberia appears to be falling, but in Sierra Leone and Guinea, new Ebola infections continue to rise, while Mali is fighting a second outbreak. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The number of U.S. health workers volunteering to go to West Africa to fight the Ebola outbreak is on the decline. The U.S. Agency for International Development says applications from volunteers has dropped about 17% since the end of October. A top U.S. doctor blames that on the way health workers are treated when they return home. He says isolating them discourages others from going to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Dr. Paul Bidinger is director of the Emergency Preparedness Response Exercise Program at the Harvard School of Public Health. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa about the treatment of American health workers who return from West Africa.
We know that the most important thing to respond to the crisis in Africa right now is to help augment the existing healthcare workforce, because we know that there are not enough healthcare workers. And we know that there now is evidence that fewer healthcare workers are signing up to volunteer to go after having seen how other healthcare workers have been treated. To make them feel stigmatized, to make them feel like public health enemies when they are doing a very noble thing, trying to go and save lives, I think is really the wrong approach. Clearly, we do want to protect public health. We want to make sure that people don't contract Ebola secondarily. But there's very good science how to protect against that. And if we follow that science, we can support our healthcare workers and help them feel confident they can go over and help, but return safely and not be stigmatized.
So how should they be treated when they arrive back home?
First off, they should be treated like the heroes that they are. They are selflessly giving of themselves. This is a long deployment for most of them. They go for usually at least 6 weeks, if not actually longer, 8-9 weeks. That's very disruptive. It's a hard, hard condition to be in. Obviously, the outbreak is really awful. And they're working under some terribly, terribly strenuous conditions. When they come back, we should be very grateful for their service. They're doing the most noble work there is. They're saving lives. And they're putting themselves, frankly, at risk. And even though the non-governmental organizations that are over there have worked so hard to minimize that risk, to augment their training, to make sure they've got the best possible personal protective equipment, it's clearly a risky situation. There's no question that, again, we do need to protect public health overall. And so those workers who are returning need to be screened and need to be checking their fever and need to know how to stay away from others if they develop any symptoms at all. But we know for sure that you do not transmit Ebola if you don't have symptoms. And therefore, anyone who comes back without symptoms is absolutely not a risk to the public health in any way.
So it's best, in your view, to have them self-monitor for any possible signs of Ebola?
So the CDC has put forward very good criteria, which is that they do self-monitoring, but if they have had direct contact with patients with Ebola, they are unfortunately at somewhat elevated risk of potentially contracting the disease as compared to someone just in the general population. So working with health departments, working with health authorities to either self-report their temperature, meaning check in twice a day with the health department, or have the health department actually physically check on them, I think either of those is very reasonable. But more the idea of draconian restrictions on liberty, quarantining someone in a healthcare facility when they're not ill, or quarantining someone involuntarily completely at home for the full 3 weeks doesn't make sense.
Do you think the fear level that you've seen in this country has been unreasonable?
I think absolutely people have been very afraid, and that's because this is a new disease with respect to the American population. Frankly, it was a new disease with respect to the West African population, which is one of the unfortunate reasons I think it spread as much as it did. The honest answer is that this is a disease that's been around since the 1970s. We know how it's transmitted. We know how to keep people safe. And since we do know how to keep people safe, we shouldn't unnecessarily limit people's liberty when they're going to try and do the right thing, because they just don't represent a threat to the public health.
How important is it for international healthcare workers to be in West Africa?
It's incredibly important. We know for sure that there are not enough doctors and nurses in West Africa right now. And other nations have really done a remarkable job of trying to help support healthcare workers. The European Union has actually put together a special medical evacuation program in case someone were to become ill in West Africa so that they would be evacuated to tertiary care hospitals in either Africa or elsewhere in the world. And they are paying for that themselves as a sign of their commitment to ensuring adequate healthcare staff go and volunteer. So there unfortunately are not sufficient doctors and nurses that are well trained in that area that can respond to the outbreak. They need outside help right now, and that's what we should be trying to support.
We've heard that some who are evacuated from West Africa and brought to the United States for treatment often have to foot the bills themselves for those evacuation flights. Have you heard about that?
I have heard about that. Again, one of the amazing things I think about the European Union decision is that they are footing the bill. They are offering to foot the bill to get the volunteers back to Europe. It's a tremendous commitment. We've heard discussions of similar potential issues, I believe, from U.S. agencies. And that represents a tremendous commitment because although the chance of becoming infected is low, it is a real chance. And it's obvious that healthcare workers would like to know that they can receive the best possible care if, God forbid, they become ill. But ultimately now, I think we're seeing a wonderful movement towards offering additional security to aid workers so that they can respond, know that they will be protected, and know that they won't have extraordinary costs if they have to be evacuated.
What lessons have been learned from the Ebola crisis that might be applied to future outbreaks from some different disease?
I think it's too early, unfortunately, to say if the lesson has been learned, but it's that we have to pay attention to outbreaks like these early and try and enhance our aid response early. Organizations such as Doctors Without Borders were asking as early as March for a robust international health response, and unfortunately, that didn't happen for a very, very long time. I really would hope that as a global community, we've learned some lessons about this. I think, unfortunately, we won't know until the next outbreak whether we've actually learned this lesson.
Dr. Paul Bittinger, director of the Emergency Preparedness Response Exercise Program at the Harvard School of Public Health. Two Egyptian senior military leaders were killed today ahead of planned protests by Islamists who want to topple the military-backed government. Security officials say the army officers were shot by unidentified assailants in separate attacks in and just north of the capital, Cairo. The ultra-conservative Salafi Front has called for nationwide demonstrations today as part of what it calls Muslim Youth Uprising. The group, which is pushing for the imposition of Islamic law, wants its supporters to wave Qurans in the air at the rallies. Authorities have increased security at key locations and have warned of tough response if the protests turn violent. It is the most concerted effort in months to rally opposition against the government of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Mr. Sisi, the ex-army chief, oversaw last year's overthrow of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first elected president. Mr. Morsi was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has also supported today's call for protests. Since Mr. Morsi's overthrow, the government has jailed tens of thousands of Muslim Brotherhood members and supporters. Hundreds have also been killed in violence that often breaks out during protests, which have been dwindling. A new report urges the poorest countries in the world to shift from low to high productivity activities to improve their economies. In its annual Least Developed Countries report, UNCTAD, the UN Conference on Trade and Development, says these countries must structurally transform their economies to free themselves from the poverty trap, which is stunting economic growth and development. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the report was released.
Of the 48 nations the UN considers least developed countries, or LDCs, only one, Laos, is on track to achieve all seven of the Millennium Development Goals by 2015. And only four African countries, Ethiopia, Malawi, Rwanda, and Uganda, are likely to meet a majority of these targets. This assessment is particularly grim in light of the even greater challenges awaiting these countries in the coming years. The MDGs set a goal for nations to have their poverty levels by 2015. The so-called Sustainable Development Goals, which carry on from where the MDGs leave off, call for the eradication of poverty by 2030. Teferi Tesfatu, an UNCTAD official who works with Africa, says it would be nothing short of a miracle for the LDCs to pull this off. In order for the least developed countries to achieve this miraculous performance, he says, they will need to structurally change their economies. He tells VOA this means shifting labor from activities with low productivity, such as small-scale agriculture and services, to more dynamic activities with higher productivity, such as manufacturing and high-value services.
Countries that have moved up are the ones that are creating opportunities for those that are leaving agriculture to engage in things where they add value or they get training. And as it happens, manufacturing tends to have that feature. That's why this call for manufacturing. Countries that are using policies to shift and influence capital and labor to move into this activity sectors tend to do better.
Tesfatu says these high productivity sectors tend to pay higher wages and create a demand for goods. This, he says, encourages investment. On the surface, it appears that the LDCs are not doing badly. UNCTAD economic data show growth in these poor countries between 2002 and 2008 exceeded the 7% target set by the international community. And even after the 2008 financial crisis, UNCTAD notes the LDCs grew faster than other developing countries at an average of 5.7% per year. But UN economists say the outlook for the least developed countries in the short and medium term remains uncertain. They say increasing people's productivity is the best way to break the human and economic development that continues to entrap them in poverty. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The number of U.S. health workers volunteering to go to West Africa to fight the Ebola outbreak is on the decline. Cameroon officials have banned six journalists from exercising their profession. And two Egyptian senior military officers were killed today ahead of a planned protest by Islamists who want to topple the military-backed government. Coming up, music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, the first and only rehabilitation center for disabled children in Uganda. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yehiz.
So what do you have for us on the sports menu this evening?
Well, Yehiz, I'll kick off with African football. Thanks.
Great, great.
Thank
Sounds
you.
Sounds great.
In the African Confederation Cup, seven-time African champions, Egypt's Al Ahly faced Ivorian side Sewe Sport in the Confederation Cup final. The first leg of the final is in Abidjan on Saturday, with the return match scheduled for a week later in Cairo. Interestingly, the two sides met in the group stages of the tournament, which ended in a 1-1 draw in Ivory Coast before Ahly won their home tie 1-0. This year has not been so good for Egypt, the African football giant. After decades of football successes at national team and club levels, the Pharaohs failed for a record third consecutive time to reach the Africa Cup of Nations finals, a competition they have won a record seven times. Ahly, who have won the Africa Champions League title a record three straight times in a row, were eliminated by Libyan namesake El Ahly Benghazi in the final qualifying round of the group phase. Fellow Cairo club Zamalek did make the mini-league stage, only to finish bottom of the table. Neither Ismailia nor Wadi Degla, the original 2014 Confederation Cup entrants from the North African state, got beyond the qualifying stage. So, Al Ahly just might restore some pride in Egyptian football if they can win the Confederation Cup final. Still in African football, it's less than 2 months to the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations final in Equatorial Guinea. Giants Nigeria and Egypt failed to make it to the finals, but the small island nation of Cape Verde not only led their group, but was among the first to qualify. My colleague Sunny Young reached out to our football guru, David Legg, in Johannesburg, South Africa, to find out what makes the Blue Sharks tick. Here is Sunny.
First off, David, the Blue Sharks from Cape Verde, they've been playing some quality football the past few years. Your thoughts?
That's right, Sonny. What they've proved, I believe, in Group F is that performance in 2013 was no fluke. Just to remind our listeners to the Sunny Side of Sport, they came to the 2013 finals in South Africa as debutants. And I think most people felt that, well, the Sharks, they won't be biting too much. But they did very well. They held South Africa, they held Morocco, and then they beat fellow Portuguese-speaking team Angola to reach the quarterfinals. And their 2-0 defeat by Ghana actually flattered the Black Stars, who certainly were not two goals better than the Cape Verdeans. And it's an amazing story, Sonny. This is a country which consists of a whole lot of islands, off the west coast of Africa, and a total population of about 500,000 people. It's tiny. I mean, when you think that there are so many Nigerians, so many South Africans, so many Egyptians, and here's a country of 500,000 people, and they don't have a particularly strong local league, and their club sides never really feature strongly in the CAF club competitions. But lo and behold, at national level, things are just on the up and up. And they actually, Sonny, were the first country to qualify. They qualified in after match day 4. And here we have a group with a recent winner of the competition in Zambia, and yet Cape Verde finished top of the table. And the Zambians, Sonny, after a rather poor start in which they were held at home by Mozambique and then lost away to the Cape Verde Islands, they've come back strongly, unbeaten in 4 games. And they did beat Cape Verde 1-0, I think probably an important psychological victory. Mozambique, they threatened early on, but the crucial match for them was the penultimate game against Zambia, which they lost 1-0 in Maputo. And really disappointing are Niger. Now, Niger, of course, have been minnows of African football, but they reached the last 2 Africa Cup of Nations tournaments. And I believe they'll be extremely disappointed that from 6 matches, the best they could manage was 3 draws. So well done against those Blue Sharks. Aside, incidentally, Sonny, that are ranked 4th in Africa. I think that might be slightly flattering, but FIFA, they do these rankings very carefully, and that's the position they're in. There's only 3 countries above them, and they are Algeria, Ivory Coast, and Tunisia. So for a country of 500,000 people, they're not doing too badly.
Finally, David, Group G, Tunisia, the 2004 Nations Cup champion, tops the table with 14 points. 1 point in arrears is Senegal. And then at the bottom of the table, we have Egypt and Botswana. How did you see Group G, David?
Sonny, Group G was considered to be the group of death. And unfortunately, that's exactly what it turned out to be for Egypt. For the first time ever, for the first time since 1957, when the Africa Cup of Nations kicked off, Egypt are going to miss 3 consecutive Cup of Nations tournament finals. It has never happened before. They have missed 2 on a couple of occasions, but never 3 in a row. Really sad. And yet, Sonny, it could all have been so different right at the death of this group, because in their final match, Egypt knew that if they won by 2 goals in Tunisia, they would pip DR Congo for the best third place finish. And an early goal from Salah gave them a 1-0 halftime lead. So they were with 45 minutes left, they basically needed to double their lead, and they would have squeezed in through the back door. But the Tunisians came back. They equalized early in the second half, and then Kasri scored the winning goal 9 minutes from the end. And that confirmed Tunisia as the group winners, and also confirmed that Egypt would miss out on the Africa Cup of Nations. Tunisia and Senegal, both very impressive in this group. The Senegalese finishing with a comfortable and expected 3-0 victory over Botswana. And there will be 2 sides challenging strongly for honours in Equatorial Guinea. From an Egyptian point of view, Sonny, I believe there are several reasons why they have slipped down the ladder. The one is that the great golden generation of 2006 to 2010, led by the legendary Mohamed Abu Trika, those players have all gone. They've retired, and age has caught up with them. And what new coach Garib was unable to do was to find adequate replacements for those players. That's one issue. Another issue, of course, is the ongoing security issues in Egypt, which means that many matches are played behind closed doors. There have also been many disruptions for football where local games have not been played. That situation has improved now, but it has clearly had an effect on the national team. And they'll be very disappointed, Sonny, to have lost twice to Senegal and also twice to Tunisia. I believe the Egyptians would have expected to do much better in Cairo against those 2 clubs. If you think about it, Egypt, they had not lost at home until they lost in the previous competition to Central African Republic. And now they've also lost at home to Senegal and Tunisia, which means after this great 44-match unbeaten run in qualifiers, they've now lost 3 of the last 4. And that's a clear indication that Egyptian football is tumbling downhill. And Garib has already been told, Sonny, that if he didn't qualify for the finals, he would lose his job, and they'll probably also look overseas. So the 2 biggest casualties of the qualifying competition, Nigeria and Egypt, expect new coaches of the Super Eagles and the Pharaohs in the not-too-distant future.
Football guru David Legg in Johannesburg, South Africa, speaking with my colleague Sunny Young.
You want to listen to the latest African music? Just tune in to the African Beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays at exactly 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
African Beat. We love it!
I feel good!
But right now, you're listening to the sunny side of sports, so check it out.
Now we go to Johannesburg, South Africa, where Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma has more sports news, beginning with the FIFA rankings.
Guinea are Africa's most improved national team, while Egypt have slipped by the widest margin, according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland on Thursday. Ranked 18th, Algeria's Desert Fox are Africa's highest-placed team. Tunisia is 22nd, Ivory Coast 24th, Senegal 35th, Ghana 37th, Guinea 38th, Cameroon 41st, African champions Nigeria 42nd, Mali 49th, and South Africa 51st. In Ivory Coast, lethal striker Roger Assali, the most valuable player in the Ivory Coast Premier League, leads Sewe Sports attack when they host Egypt's El Ahly in the opening leg of the Orange Africa Confederations Cup final in Abidjan tomorrow Saturday. Assali has 4 goals to his credit in the Confederations Cup campaign. Sewe Sports are up against Africa's most successful club, El Ahly, who have won 18 Orange African Champions League titles and an Afro-Asian Cup. El Ahly's impressive trophy cabinet confirm them as having won more international trophies than any club in the world. Italy's AC Milan and Argentina's Boca Juniors are second and third respectively. Nonetheless, the new-look El Ahly side seek to break new grounds by becoming the first Egyptian club to win the Orange Africa Confederations Cup.
Mark Omar reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks, Mark. And lastly, both of the London 2012 Olympic Games marathon champions, Stephen Kiprotich and Tiki Gelana, will be heading to the 2015 Tokyo Marathon on February 22nd, according to the organizers of the IAAF Gold Label Road Race. The pair, who will also both go to Tokyo with points to prove after a difficult 12-month period when they have been unable to reproduce the form which took them to their Olympic triumphs. Kiprotich from Uganda is familiar with the Tokyo Marathon after having finished third there in 2012, running what is still his second best time of 2 hours, 7 minutes and 50 seconds, his last marathon before his victory in London. After 12th place in the London Marathon in April and 5th place in the New York Marathon earlier this month, Kiprotich will be keen to get a good result in the Japanese capital in what could be his last marathon before he defends his global crown at the 2015 IAAF World Championships in Beijing next August. Formerly based in Japan, Gelana ran the Yokohama International Women's Marathon earlier this month, where the Ethiopian was sixth in 2 hours, 29 minutes and 13 seconds, suggesting that she has still not got back to her 2012 form, following her well-publicized collision with a wheelchair racer in the 2013 London Marathon. Organizers also said that a staggering 304,825 people had entered for the 28,400 available places in the race for the general public. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Sunny Young will be back again next week. Now back to your house.
Thank you, Douglas, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the first and only rehabilitation center for disabled children in Uganda. And next, a Moroccan rapper found guilty for insulting an institution and inciting drug use. But first, some music. Here is Mani Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Yoba Yoba, Yoba Yoba, Yoba Yoba, Mana Wama.
kusinzira yara dufite turabuzo korobatatu twibera mu mataba twiragira inkazi wacu akadukamira yera tukanywa tukanyurwa tukitetera umukuru muri twe akabinajorwa umukurikiye akabinarumikwa Tomoribo, Matacumo, Gavada, Terba, Mundi, Mayo, Mashenge,
Yobayo, Tangira kuryana byato nato bazo tubonye bikamurenga bikamuyobera bikamushobera sogokuru yaje kuducira umugani nako numufindo mbambaroga afata inkoni eshatu arazibangikanya azibohesha umurungu ukomeye ati bana banjye mumaze kuba abagabo ngaho nimuvunaguriza inkoni ndeba bana banjye muri twe arazizingira zimunaniye zikikiriza ubuheta nangiye ture nizana mwereke araho dufatanije twazivunagura inkoni dituberi bamba ziratunanira
aye mama mvubire
aye mama
mvubire
aye mama
Azifata, azikuraho wa murunga, arazikunyagura imwe kuyindi. Dukora tugira tumumaze kubona abana banjye nimuguma hamwe, ntawuzabatera nimuguma kuryana, bazabavunagura nk'izi nkoni.
Manny Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba. Outside of Kampala, a rehabilitation center known as KORSU, or Comprehensive Rehabilitation Services for Uganda, is doing extraordinary work by bringing together doctors, volunteers, and donations from around the globe. They've established the first and only rehabilitation center for disabled children in the country. Elizabeth Pollott reports from Kampala, Uganda.
At KORSU, the focus is on abilities, not disabilities. On a lush grassy lawn outside of the main hospital, a mix of current and former patients take center stage, competing in a round of sports games and silly dances. The theme of the day being, let them play. For children with missing limbs, deformities, and trauma, this is a rare event. The purpose is to raise money for a new playground and sports field. They want to transform their old playground into an area that's friendly for all sorts of disabilities, whether it's missing limbs or limited movement. Life for the disabled in Uganda is difficult, but for children it can be devastating. Christine Tusime, the principal physiotherapist at KORSU, describes the challenges facing the disabled here.
That is like what stops them from playing like other kids, from socializing with other people. And usually when they try to socialize, they are then stigmatized or called names depending on their disability. Of course, from that, they tend to get a low self-esteem, so they stop socializing and then they have all that whole psychological issues or challenges that come out from not being able to interact with kids their age, not being able to play, and generally not being able to go to school, even if the parents wanted to take them out for a social evening or something, to the theater, to the museum. It's very hard to do that because they can't access the structures that are there.
Corsu treats patients from all over Uganda and some surrounding areas, including South Sudan and the DRC. Inside the compound, there are surgical theaters, therapy rooms, dorms, and even a primary school. Therapies can last from a few days to a couple months. They also integrate support groups for parents and families who sometimes have trouble understanding the disability. The employees at Corsu take immense pride in what they do. Moses Dennis Kawisa is a prosthetics technologist. He grew up with a family member who had lost a leg, and it spurred an interest in prosthetic development. He says children, by far, are some of his favorite clients.
If you don't walk, and then end up walking, you really feel good.
Yeah.
Especially kids, say. That's why they don't take long when you feed them. 1-2 days they are running. But you know, it's really interesting to see one walking. You know, when someone comes in not walking, not able to walk, not able to do other things, then the smiles they give, you know, the happiness, you know, they get to do new things, you know, running and playing.
Yeah.
To just make our day by day.
Corsu receives no funding from the government and relies primarily on the kindness of donors, most of which come from abroad. They supplement their income by providing pharmacy, x-ray, and laboratory services to the neighborhoods surrounding them. They are hoping that in the future, a self-sustaining practice will be possible. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
That's Moroccan rapper known as Mr. Crazy. He was released 2 weeks ago from a 3-month in prison for singing about police corruption, drugs, youth unemployment. In August, the 17-year-old Artman Atik was found guilty of insulting an institution and inciting drugs. Human Rights Watch Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa Division, Eric Goldstein, tells Ricky Shryock that Morocco's actions are a violation of Atik's freedom of expression.
Atik is from a gritty area of Casablanca, and he sings about what he knows best, which is the life of teenage boys who don't have jobs, have an outlook on the future, and get involved in drugs, petty crime, hanging out, doing nothing, drinking. And that's what he sings about, much in the manner of some rappers in the United States and in France. And the words in the videos are explicit. You know, they talk about crime and drugs. And perhaps this is why the Moroccan authorities decided to muzzle him.
You mentioned it as well, that his songs and music videos depict the lives of specifically sometimes Casablanca's unemployed youth. Do you think that one reason he was made a target is because that is a sensitive issue?
The charge against him is harming public morality. He's singing about real social problem. Anybody who visits Casablanca knows that he's talking about a reality in that country, and shooting the messenger isn't going to solve the problem. This is the reflex of the government. He's the second rapper who talks about this milieu to go to jail.
So both Atik and another rapper known as Al Hakid have been both jailed, and specifically sometimes for songs that were deemed to be insulting to the police. Do human rights experts such as yourself believe there are serious issues that need to be addressed in terms of the Moroccan police?
The problem is with the Moroccan law. The Moroccan Constitution of 2011 proclaims that there is the freedom to create artwork, there's the freedom to express oneself, and yet the laws that are on the books and that continue to be enforced penalize various types of expression, including so-called insults against the police. Now, in this case, and in the case of Al Hakid, both rappers talk about police corruption. Their defense in court is they're talking about those police men and women who are corrupt. They're not talking about the police as an institution. If Morocco wants to implement the constitution that it adopted with so much fanfare 3.5 years ago, it has to abolish laws that put people in prison for basically criticizing state institutions, state bodies such as police.
That was Eric Goldstein, Human Rights Watch Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa Divisions. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Bill Barber, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Lack of access to clean water and basic sanitation is one of the most pressing problems facing the developing world today. These two interrelated requirements are fundamental to healthy lives and prosperous communities. Yet nearly 783 million people worldwide do not have access to clean drinking water, and more than 2.5 billion people do not have access to safe sanitation for adequate disposal of human waste. The consequences of inadequate access to water and sanitation are tremendous: diarrhea-related illness and disease, poor quality of life, public and environmental health, and low economic growth, but also factors that are far harder to quantify, like dignity and security. Nearly 2 million people die from diarrhea each year, many of them children under the age of 5 living in the developing world. As the global population continues to shift toward urban areas, the challenge of ensuring access to water and sanitation is only expected to become more complex. India is a case in point. Although the booming economy of the past decade has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of extreme poverty, rapid urbanization and an inadequate water delivery system and sanitation infrastructure are hindering further development. Thus, sanitation and clean water are the government of India's top developmental priority. When President Barack Obama and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi met in Washington in early October, they signed an agreement that will help bring clean water and sanitation services to all Indians. Consequently, in early November, U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID Administrator Rajiv Shah, announced a new financial commitment of up to $20 million to support water and sanitation efforts in India, subject to the availability of funds. Shah also announced a new Urban Water Sanitation and Hygiene, or WASH, knowledge partnership with the Indian Ministry of Urban Development. Under the partnership, the United States and India, in cooperation with other key partners, such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, will share expertise and global best practices and demonstrate innovative and scalable models in urban water and sanitation. Shah also announced USAID support for a new multi-stakeholder coalition that will catalyze a nationwide movement around healthy WASH behaviors. Together, said USAID Administrator Rajiv Shah, we are working to unlock opportunity for India's most vulnerable people and pioneer solutions that will help end extreme poverty across the globe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA